Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into the interview. Right away, we have Noelle Elgrably. Did I say that right?
Elgrably.
Elgrably, damn it. Man, I was so close. I'm monkeying around with your name. That's no good. Well, say hello to our studio audience.
Hey guys, that's I'm actually happy to be here. We've been trying to get this together. I've been trying to come in here for a while, man.
Well, we've been playing reschedule. I've been doing it probably more, you know, just because schedules are crazy with artists, man.
Dude,
it is
LA,
and it's just the way it is. Where are you from, by the way?
I grew up on the East Coast in the D.C. area. Actually, I usually say D.C. because I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which is just about 5 minutes south of it.
Yeah,
but everybody hears Arlington or Virginia, and they think I should have a southern accent. Like, you know, you don't sound like a southern boy. You know,
so like, it's not always like that over there.
And it's
you know, I used to study music in a city called Winchester, Virginia.
Winchester, okay. I don't know.
It's about 50. You know where that is?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay,
yeah.
So I used to study almost every summer there. In college, and I fell in love with Virginia, man. What a great state. Beautiful.
It's lush and green.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, when my sister lived out here for a while, too, she actually grew up here. My parents met here in L.A. like, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Oh, that's crazy.
And then I ended up being the kid that was born over there. But when she moved out here, we would make fun of things that we saw in, like, you know, Bugs Bunny, like Rancho Cucamonga. I thought that was a joke. I didn't think that existed.
You're like, that's not a real city. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, you know, or Pismo Beach. And we thought those were just made up. And then, so we'd laugh about it, but then we realized back home in Virginia, they have things like Frying Pan Road, Backlick Road, you know, Pohick Road. So it's the stereotypes go both ways on both coasts.
And it's funny because it's like every city, you don't know who makes these names up, but somebody's got a sense of humor. You know, well, it's like.
Plus they run out of names.
Yeah.
And like eventually after Smithville or, you know, or Robert Street.
Or Springfield.
Springfield is like everywhere. Like
you're right.
There's 1,000 Springfields over there. They're like, why don't we name it Redneck Hair Road? You know, they don't care. They pick up something.
They're like, let's do it. You miss Virginia?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I miss about Virginia and the East Coast. I lived for a little bit around the East Coast. So, you know, Virginia, D.C., New Jersey, New York, and that sort of thing. So I sort of, there's a lot of, I'll be honest, mostly the food.
Yeah, I was about to say my favorite steak sandwich is in Virginia.
Yeah. Where? Really?
Oh, my God. I can't remember the name of the place, but it was in Winchester.
Winchester.
I mean, it was like, it wasn't like a cheesesteak. It was like little thin slices, so thin. It was one of the most incredible places. And like the place I heard burned down.
Oh,
and the city was in like so like sad about it that they raised enough money to open it again, like with the city's help.
Yeah, they probably were like mourning like the day Dale Earnhardt died.
I mean, I was sad when I heard that, and then I was like, yes, it came back. It's amazing. I'm not even there just because, the food. There's something about the food in certain places.
Well,
you know?
I grew up, funny that you mentioned that, I grew up on not far from a place called Glebe Road in Columbia Pike, and that's where the original Five Guys was.
Oh, wow.
So I actually, years ago when I was younger, I knew Jerry Morrell, who started
crazy.
Five Guys, and we used to actually, I studied karate with him.
What?
And his sons. So his son, one of his sons was the black belt and that sort of thing. And so we all knew each other. So we were doing like jiu-jitsu and karate and stuff like that.
What belt did you get to?
I went up there pretty high, man. You know, I
that's
got there,
crazy.
I'd been doing martial arts since I was like, you know, 8 or 9 years old. And a lot of, and then afterwards when he got really in vogue to do like Brazilian jiu-jitsu and
So you know all the grapples and the holes.
Grapples and stuff like that. And then we did a lot of weapon stuff. So, I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a part of my youth that you couldn't, you know, you can't let go sometimes. Like, you know, I'm older now. Like, both of us are not small guys.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, absolutely. To the listening audience out there, I'm looking at us in the reflection in the mirror. We're not small guys.
Our bellies are almost touching.
Yeah, exactly. And if we had hard-ons, it would have to be doubled for them to even touch before our bellies did. And so I'm sure you're going to hear a lot of, you know, great critiques and, you know, advice about where to eat and stuff like that. But, you know, when you get older, you know, now I'm in my 40s and I think back and I used to do splits and blah, blah, blah. And all, you know, you fight in the ring and things like that. And then you get older and then you're like,
I can't do much. I'm like getting out of bed, like, oh, that hurt. I don't know what I did, but it's something.
When I sit down at a table with other Jews, we have like what they call misery poker. Like, when, you know, I got this back thing. Yeah, you think that's bad. I have my dick fell off last week. Oh, yeah, I got a flu that destroys your liver. You know, they just go, it's like they up the ante. It's like, you know, I call you and I raise you with another illness. So it's like, and we're getting like my buddy of mine, Angelo Sarukis, he's a Canadian comic, great guy, like a big brother. He travels all over the world, and he, you know, we've gotten older. So if we share a hotel room, if we're on the road, I got a picture of our CPAP machines together. Like, it looks cute. like an old gay couple, like, right. You know, like on the bedstand between the bed, we got two CPAPs there.
Just to get through the night.
Yeah, that's how wild the party that, you know, I mean, let's go back and let's vape from our CPAPs. You know, I mean, it's like, just get older. You know what I mean?
Well, how did you get into comedy in Arlington, Virginia?
I think it's, I actually didn't start till I came out to LA. Hmm. So it's one of those stories that, you hear all the time. You hear, like, you know, there's somebody that's really funny. Your friends tell you you're funny.
A class clown.
Yeah, class clown. Yeah. And I was literally, like, I was a class delinquent. Like, I remember my mother would cry every year during the parent-teacher conference day because she'd show up and my desk was always next to the teachers and I couldn't sit in general population. Like, I never got to sit in general population because they're like, if I put him in there, then he's going to cause trouble or he's going to laugh, you know. And then you go through and you're like the guy at dinner parties, and my sister would have parties and I'd be there and she'd be like, you have to come. You know, she didn't like me. She just wanted me to come there because her friends thought I was funny. You know, so she'd like, you have to come and, you know, make my friends laugh. And then you hear that over and over again. And I kind of stayed away from it. I did a lot of other things. I went to school, you know, and then I came.
What'd you study in school?
Criminology.
Whoa. Wow. That's a far stretch from comedy.
Criminology. And I had a
minor. Like, what can I study that'll be the most unfunny thing in life? Criminology. There
and,
it is.
And a minor in abnormal psych.
That sounds terrible. Man, that makes my back ache just hearing that. Jeez.
Yeah, the only good thing about it is I it's not good because it doesn't work, but I can figure out how crazy a girl is I'm dating after it's already been, it's gone bad. So I haven't developed the preventative, you know, precognition. Now it's just, you know, I can be reactive.
Well, the funny thing is, it's like I studied music in school and they gave us huge books and crazy homework assignments. And I used to think, what if I actually was studying something really academic? I can't imagine the homework assignments some of you guys had. You know, like, that's crazy.
Yeah, but it was really interesting stuff. Like, we had a lot of professors that were, we had guys that were FBI agents and cops and that sort of thing. So they had some real life experience, and then they would tell you these stories and you'd hear about, you know, they'd tell you the real deal.
Oh, that's cool.
And it wasn't like, CSI, it was criminal science. So it was like, you know, how to catch a crook, not how to think like one or how to analyze him. So it was really, you know, like if you see a guy running down a hallway, you know, with a, you know, a butcher knife and carrying a TV that's been ripped out of a wall, you know, he's probably a criminal. That's probable cause or whatever, you know, that type of thing. So it was never like, you know, I watched CSI and I was like, man, I should have done that, where they're like taking, like, you know, carpet samples. Like, we found a pubic hair that puts him at the scene of the crime, you know, like that type of stuff.
Yikes. That sounds gross.
And so, you know, comics always, people in general, like, everybody's got like that uncle that's hilarious. Everybody wants to be around him and stuff like that. And I think there's this kind of like, it's almost like a myth or a fairy tale they tell these people. You know, they tell them, like, you know, you should be a comedian. You're so funny. And then I found out the hard truth, which is being funny at the dinner table or like parties, whatever.
It's like the warm up.
Yeah. It's like a different type of funny. That's like, you know, oh, that, what a character, what a card. That guy's, oh, what a rapscallion. He's hilarious. His little jokes, you know. And you're pulling shit from out of the air and saying stuff. And your friend's like, do the joke about the cockroaches and whatever it is, you know, and you're telling stuff, you know, and they think that's like, you know, oh, this guy could just get on stage. In their mind, they think comics just pop on stage and just start talking. And
yeah, you know what? It's such a myth. Yeah. And it's like, the funny thing about comedians, it's like, you don't realize how much craft and how much whittling down the joke.
Yeah.
Years. It could take years to whittle down a joke properly with the timing and the accents and the whatever it is to get it right.
And it can soar or it can fail depending on the crowds. And there are some guys that get up there and just sort of free ball it. And I think every comic's been on stage where they're on stage and they do writing on stage, where you're on stage and you're telling a joke and then you hit it with a tag. And by tag, I mean, you know, something like a side piece, like a side dish with it. You right. know, like a,
you're making me hungry.
That's that's why I went straight to food.
Hit him with some
like
pizza.
You get him an appetizer and then a side dish. And you do something, and they're like, oh, wait a minute, this opens a door to this, and this opens a door to that. And then next thing you know, you're writing on stage. And there's some guys that are so gifted, they just, boom, they just improv, bang, bang, bang on stage. But I think a lot of it is also in the beginning. Like, you're never going to hear clips of Robin Williams or Richard Pryor or anybody in the first, like, 3, 4, 5 years, because it's not good. If everybody takes time to sort of, like, ease in and sort of figure their way out, you know, and acclimate to the world and acclimate to comedy and stage and mics and all those things, and figure out their voice and how they want to talk, who they want to be. And sometimes it takes, I don't think I've even found it yet. You know, I mean, it's, you learn those things as you start doing it, and it's tough. Like, people ask me, I have a friend who works in film, and she was asking me the other day, she's like, I like to get into comedy. And I'm like, no, you don't. And she's like, no, I want to. I was like, no, you don't. And she's like, well, I read this book. And I was like,
Like, just because Steve Martin wrote a book.
Yeah. Yeah. You can read all Steve Martin's books and everything, and they're not going to tell you about, you know, the open mics and basically eating bowls of shit over and over again and the rejection. And you don't even exist, you know, for the first number of
years. It's so ridiculous how it works, too. Yeah. And, like, the crazy thing is, you know, with Eddie being my co-host, he was like, show me, you know, like, when you rehearse in a band, which is what I do. He's like, you rehearse and you can rehearse. Mm. He's like, our rehearsal is the performance. You know what I mean? Like,
what you're going to do.
Yeah. And I never thought about it like that. Like, oh my God. Like, I always just assume when a comedian gets up there, it's polished and it's ready. But it's like, sometimes the joke ain't ready yet. And, like, they'll have jokes that already are ready.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're like this. And then they'll have a new joke that they're starting to whittle while they know these I can bank on, but I got to still whittle this one down for the next.
Yeah.
15 minutes or 10 minutes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think all of them, every comic is different, just like every musician is different. And I think a lot of, you know, like if you watch, you know, Chappelle's most recent special, Sticks and Stones, which I thought was awesome as well.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, I mean, he was spending time and he was crafting those jokes and he was trying out different iterations, seeing what works, what doesn't work, what works and doesn't work for him, as well as what works and doesn't work for the audience.
Yeah.
How things set in. And then he decides, like, you know, how am I going to take this order? Where am I going to go here and tell this sort of comedic story? And he's a master at his craft, right? So he figured that stuff out while he was on the road. And then, boom, he says, now I'm ready to do it. And he does it in his special. And then you look and you're like, my God, this is amazing. You know, it's like unbelievable. And Bill Burr did his recent one, too, which is a lot like that. It's almost like they're conversation.
Those are two of my favorite comedians right there.
They're top of the heap, man.
Yeah.
And it's like they're doing it conversationally. Like, they're having a conversation or with the audience. And you feel like...
Yeah.
They're coming up with it right then. And I guarantee you probably some of that stuff probably did come
Well, it's
up with
making that. It look easy. You know, the funny thing about Chappelle's last special, I had an opportunity. John Mayer was playing at the Hotel Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually met Chappelle, but I didn't realize that I was meeting him in the moment because he actually doesn't really look like he does on TV. He's a little skinnier. He looks a little bit like quieter. You know, like he just is not like that when he's on stage. You know, so like... You know, the show was sold out and I was trying to get in and, you know, he walks up to the door and I'm like, hey man, do you have an extra ticket for this? And he was like, no man, sorry man. And then he walked in. I was like, oh shit, that was Dave Chappelle. What? What is he doing here? And then he ended up going up on stage because he and Mayer were doing this New Year's Eve show that they were doing music and comedy together and they were working out bits for this show. So I watched the bits start there and then I saw the completed version for the performance on New Year's Eve, and then I saw some of those jokes make it in
stage. Oh, it's
in
special.
So
yeah.
I saw him go through those, and like I saw how he changed little things, like the timing, or like when he pulled the jokes out, or like even just, you know. And it's kind of genius how they make it look like it's like a magician.
Yeah,
you're kind of like magicians. Like you make it look like it's just all part of your everyday vernacular, you know. But it's really not. It's like this carefully methodical planned experiment that looks like it's happening on the fly, but it's not.
Right. At least for Chappelle, at least.
Well, what's your process? Tell me what your process is when you come up with a joke, when you work it out, how long does it take for you to know that it's there?
I think some guys sit down, they do it basically the academic way. Like I remember reading something about Jerry Seinfeld where he said that that everything changed for him one day when he was at home and he decided to be a comic, and he looked out the window and he saw a construction crew working, and he said, they're construction workers and they work 8 hours a day. A guy goes to an office, he works 8 hours a day. So he said, I'm a comedian, so I'm going to write jokes for 8 hours a day. So he said he would force himself to sit down and basically at least think about it, at least think about the process, at least try to write something down, at least to come up with some ideas, and then continue on. And I think things that struck him as funny, he sort of put together and worked on and capitalized. And I think there's other guys that are just like, you know, that just comes to them. It's organic. They get on stage, they start talking about stuff, and then boom, it would come to them. So I think the process is different for everybody. For me, a lot of it is, you know, in speaking in passing with friends. Like, one of my pastimes is smoking cigars. So I spend a lot of time in cigar lounges, even when you're on the road.
You and my brother would be like buds, dude.
It's the best. Yeah, it's like the last bastion of masculinity, by the way, too.
Yeah.
Because girls don't like the smell. So a lot of times. But the problem is you get in there and it's a lot of like really kind of like archaic minded guys, too.
Right.
You know? So you're sort of in the middle. You're like, you know, this guy, I don't know about this guy, you know. He's like, the South shall rise again. You hear stuff like that, you know. But there's a lot of really great people you meet in cigar lounge, and women, men, everybody. But so it's this open forum kind of. A lot of them have these situations where they have couches and chairs situated facing each other. So you start getting these conversations. And I'm always amazed at the topics that they talk about: religion, politics, sex, anything that's taboo in most regular conversations they bring up. And so what happens is everybody starts riffing. They start talking. And then as a comic, you're in there, and I'll just, something strikes me as funny, and I'll say it, and I'll riff off somebody else, and then it becomes this organic thing in there. And you're like, oh, my God, that's actually that's a great premise. That's funny. And then I'll think about it, and then I'll try it with some friends somewhere else, or I'll mention it to somebody, or you'll go over it in your mind. You're like, yeah, I could do this, and you could go here, and then you try it on stage and see if the premise even hits a little bit, you know?
Right.
And the next thing you know, you're crafting this joke based on this idea you had. And then there's some things that you're looking down on a piece of paper, and you write something, you're like, oh, this will go, this is funny, and this topic here, this current event, kind of reminds me of this. And you just literally go from what passes through your mind, then you go, oh, and this connects to this, and connects to this, and connects to this, and you sort of.
But is it like a story that you want to shape in each joke? Mm-hmm. Is it like a collection of stories that you want to, okay, this is the political forum, this is the everyday life, you know, I failed at this kind of joke.
Yeah.
This is my relationship thing. This is my career or, you know, global outlook on things.
I think some guys do. I mean, it's all different. You know, like sometimes you hear, you know, comics they just pull things out of the air and connect it together. Or if they do one-liners. If they do, you know, they'll randomly, or it won't necessarily be connected. So they'll just go from one idea to the next, or they'll tell a story. Like, I like to tell a story, kind of like, who am I, where I'm from, this is my life, this is what happens. And then while I'm saying those things, sort of cushion that sandwich, like fill that sandwich with the meat of these hilarious moments or observations, right, and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of comics do that. You kind of want to have a direction, or at least take them on a journey with you. That's what it feels like. It feels like I'm taking them on a journey with me. And then if I can connect with the audience and you have that rapport, then boom, that's where the magic is, because they're on the same page as you. Because you'll talk to them and you'll be like, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about? You know, and they'll be like, yeah, you know. Or here's some guy, you'll say, hey, is there any other stepdads in the audience? Yeah, you know, and you'll, or whatever, you'll come up with something, and then somebody in the audience will key into that and connect with you, and then you take them on that journey with you. And I think, you know, Chappelle and all these guys, greats from our past, like George Carlin, Dave Chappelle, and, you know, Richard Pryor, Rob Williams, all these guys, George Carlin, all these greats, even Rodney Dangerfield, Sam Kinison, they sometimes would create things and say things that we're thinking, but we haven't put together or can't say or feel that it's not our place to say. And then they say them, that you're like, oh, yeah, it's right. Didn't I just say that last week? Or I think about that all the time, but I never mention it, you know? And they'll say those things, and they kind of pull you on that journey with them, because then they feel like they're your subconscious talking out loud. And I think that's a big deal. And I think recently Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr did a big thing. I think they fell on their sword for a lot of comics, because what they said is, we're not going to give in to this sort of PC culture. We're going to filter or basically stifle ourselves because of what people feel is an oversensitivity or whatever it may be.
Well, were you the one that posted the Mel Brooks thing?
Yeah, I did, but I'm sure 100 comics, 1,000 comics.
Which is, I agree. Yeah, I agree. It's like changing what's funny for people. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you can't laugh at anything, then you're taking something too seriously. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you have to change. Sometimes you have to change material. You'll go to some place and you'll do a joke, and it might be risque, or you're shooting for a certain point, and you overshoot it, or it's something, for some reason, that locale, the people in that locale don't like, and they're like, you'll be like, oh, and then you're like, okay, well, I can't talk about that with this group of people or this audience.
Do you find that geography has a huge influence on what jokes you're going to tell?
Yeah, big time. Because
that's strange. I think that's so strange.
I did too, but then I realized that geography outside of LA. Like if you go to in LA, there's so many comics and actors and agents and producers and writers and production people that a lot of times you're doing a show and it's filled with other people in the industry.
Right.
And if it's other comics, they're sort of looking at you sometimes like, you know, oh, I have a bit on that. That's interesting. I do a joke about that as well. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's, you know, and they sort of have, sometimes you have audiences where it's like almost in LA Central, really, like Hollywood area. Like you, it's almost as if they're like, make me laugh or, you know, we're subject to the highest levels of entertainment all the time. So you've got to really bring your A game. You know what I mean?
I always see and say that comedians performing for other comedians is a tough audience.
Oh my God.
Because it's like, even if a comedian thinks something is funny, and you know, like I've been in a room full of comedians, and you know, sometimes I'll crack a joke and I'll have people laughing, and you see the comedians go, yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
And like, I can't even imagine, like, I'm not even trying to tell jokes, you know, for a living.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine comedians, you know, having those same moments. But you know, I feel like there's something different with comedians now. As to, or maybe it's always been like this, because I watched this thing with Seinfeld and Eddie Murphy, and I didn't know that they performed. Yeah,
coffee,
yeah, and I didn't know they performed together.
Yeah,
and it was crazy how that they just projected, you know, what that person was thinking or going through
back then,
not knowing, you know, what the other person was projecting onto them. The same way, like, oh, you always had it together. He's like, I always thought you had it together, and it's like that discussion was never openly discussed, you know, like they weren't just like, man, I think you're funny, I think you're amazing. It was never like that, you know. Because so maybe
they're competitive.
Yeah, and comics, that's so silly. Yeah, that's
comics
so silly.
Are very competitive. Like I have friends that are actors, and like, oh, actors are real divas. I'm like, not like comics.
That's true.
Comics, man. A lot of comics we have a inborn insecurity that comes from probably your dysfunctional family. You know. It could be anything. Who knows where those insecurities come from? But a lot of comedy is—it's almost like a shield, and it's, for me, in some cases, like a shield or a mechanism for dealing with those insecurities.
Right.
Because you have to look at it and get some humor out of it. Otherwise, you kill yourself. You know what I mean? Like you're in situations like, it's funny, like how many comics you hear about, like you know, like Drew Carey or whoever, that were like, you know, on the apex of hitting it when they were making it, and then they were like had attempted suicide or something like that. Because they're always on that precipice of, you know, self-destruction, sabotage, insecurity, self-loathing, and then comedy.
Right.
Because as my friend Angelo always says, the Greek formula for comedy is tragedy plus time equals comedy, right?
So, that's so good. I like that.
It's, you know, the classics, but I think it's true. I think, you know, like we have to make light of our situation. You have to. You can't. What other choice do you have? You know, you can't. Sometimes when something is so bad or so serious or you feel a certain way, you got to laugh. You got to try to laugh.
Yeah.
I mean,
so do you feel like you make your best jokes when you're kind of like,
no, you know what? I see, right. So I kind of stew in my like sadness or anger or whatever it is. And I almost enjoy it. Like, I hate to say this, but like, you know, I'm driving around town and like, you know, if somebody like flicks me off or whatever, and I yell back at them or whatever, I love it. Like I had the rapport. Yeah. I had a Fitbit. And I was driving around, and I noticed that when I was driving, like, you know, somebody would yell at me, we would have like some words on the road, and I would, you know, listen. I was listening to music and driving fast, whatever. My pulse rate went down, and I was like, "What the hell? Am I getting off on this?
Wow, that's crazy.
It's kind of weird, you know." And so I feel also that though I think what happens is when I'm in a time of trouble, like I feel bad, and I don't know if it's like this for a lot of comics, but if I'm in a time of trouble and I feel bad about something or I have misgivings about something or fears or uncertainty or insecurity, when I sit with friends or family and we start talking, we laugh about things, I feel better. And then because of that upswing, because of that, the energy I'm getting from those people around me, now I'm able to think of something funny about the situation to sort of turn it around. You know, the classic making lemonade out of lemons, you know? And I think a lot of comics,
I think comedians, like, they kind of undervalue how amazing of a gift it is. You know, I think kind of society does that too. I think it's like sometimes people don't realize how hard comedians work to do their craft well. I mean, I didn't understand how hard a comedian has to work to hone in on their talents until I had an open discussion. Because, like, you know, that's one of the reasons I love doing the show. It's like finding out what people's processes are. Mm. Because I know my process as a musician, but finding out other musicians' processes helped me become a better artist. Now it's like finding how everybody creates art in their own medium has also made me a better artist. But I really have so much respect for comedians. And I feel like sometimes they're so hard on themselves about the craft that they don't realize how great of a gift it is that, you know, like if I'm going through a tragic event, let's say my plane has just crashed and there's only 5 survivors. I hope one of those people is funny because if you're in that situation, the last thing you want to do is that, you know, negative Nancy person that's just making it worse. You want to be able to have some comic relief, and that's what you give the world. You know, it's it's a tremendous gift to give somebody laughter. I think it's the best music.
But do you really want that? Like, if you have 5 people left, like the Andes Mountain, like that movie Alive, and there's one guy's cracking jokes all the time, where you're trying to, you know, start a fire or build a sled or something.
Honestly, like that would keep me sane. That's the way I get, because, like, I have a bad stand-up comedian in my brain.
Yeah.
So it's like, if somebody was cracking good jokes while I'm going through that, I would at least, like, have some sense of, okay, things aren't all bad. You know what I mean? So I'm sure. But if it was maybe you and there was another comedian, you'd be like, it would probably drive you crazy.
There's some guys that are on 24/7.
Right.
It's like, they're like, you know, I remember even when I first started, I would meet comics. Somebody would introduce me to comics and be like, hey, my name's Philly and blah, blah, blah. You know, hey, wouldn't that be funny if a red car came by and then somebody farted? You know what I'm saying? You know, they just keep going and going.
And you're like, and easy, bro. Easy. Like, be a person down, too.
Yeah. Turn off the mic. You know? There's a lot of, I think so many comics are different, but I think also there's so many comics now. It's become like, it's very prolific now. Like, I mean, there's just so many comics out there because there's so much exposure for people that are not comics.
Right.
They say, hey, I'm going to try stand-up comedy. So they do. And some people find out that they have a real knack for it, and some people don't, but they'll still get that sort of stage time. So if you think about it, LA has, you know, how many clubs does it have? The Laugh Factory, the Comedy Store, the Ice House, the Hermosa Beach Comedy Club.
Improv.
Improv, Flappers, Haha. So you're talking like a handful of clubs, and literally, supposedly, there's 9,000 to 12,000 comics in LA.
Wow.
That's impossible to service all those comics. It's impossible to get those comics in these clubs. And I think in some ways it's a detriment to the art because, you know, back in 1979 or 77, these guys, there was 200 comics that were good enough probably to tour the country. And so these guys could sort of bang out their comedy and figure out where they stand and what's good and not good and sort of reach for the brass ring and keep going for it and falling down and failing and get back up. And now, I mean, it's not as easy. So you kind of have to sort of figure out where you're at and what you're doing and adjust very quickly. And so I think that probably turns off a lot of people from doing it, but it makes it seem harder. And it is a double-edged sword because what happens? You go to places, you're doing a week someplace or whatever, you go to a place, and then every night for, you know, 15 minutes to an hour, whatever contract that is, 15 minutes to an hour per show, you get up there and then that's your job, 15 minutes to an hour. So you do that once a night or twice a night, and it might be for 5 to 7 nights or a weekend or something like that. And people look at them and they're like, oh, that's not that difficult, you know.
It's so different. I think the opposite.
Because it's so much, you know, like musicians, there's so much surrounding it.
Yeah.
You know, my buddy Angelo's on, he gets up at, he'll fly into places at 5 a.m. to do promo when he's not even going to be doing a show there for another week or something like that or what have you. You know, like, we were doing a show one time, we were on the road, and he was like, I'm going to get up and do this radio show. Why don't you come with me? I'm like, sure. I was knocked out, dead asleep at like 5 a.m. when he had to get up and go. And he said, I came in there and rolled you around. You wouldn't wake up. You know, you're snoring. So I just left. And he came back. And I woke up while he was coming back, you know, 2-3 hours later from doing whatever. It's tough. It's not easy. Especially for these guys who are on the road, like real road dogs.
That's the grind. Oh, the grind is crazy. Well, let's talk about it real quick. So when you moved to LA, what was that Zen moment? That moment of Zen, you were like, I'm going to get up and do this. Did you do an open mic?
The moment? I did this open mic at a laundromat in Culver City.
Yes.
And I'd waited for years. Me and my brother were sharing a house in Culver City, and he was like, oh, you're really funny. You should just do it, man. Just do comedy. I'm like, how do you just do comedy? I said, I'm too old, you know. And he's like, no, just try it. I'm like, all right. So I was like 30, 31. So I was like, yeah, I don't know, you know. And so I decided to do this open mic. So I wrote down my buddy Daniel comes up to me, he sits down and he says, this is what we're gonna do. He goes, all the shit you say at parties when we're out with friends and girls, whatever, Everybody laughs at the table. You know, we're going to write it down. So he starts writing down. And I still have these papers that we wrote down, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And he would start writing it down. And then you're going to look at them and try to figure something out. So I did. I looked at them and figured stuff out. And I wrote down this on a sheet. I wrote like 5 minutes, which felt like 4 hours, you know, to me. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this open mic. So I go to open mic and I have this like paper in front of me. And I'm reading from it. And I'm like, yeah, isn't it weird? And, you know, and I'm like just like trembling, you know. And it freaked me out so much. I was like, fuck that. I'm just not, it's not my thing. I do something else. I want to be creative. So maybe I'll be an actor. Or maybe I'll do something else. And then I went to Groundlings. I did Groundlings for a little bit, a couple classes there, and almost got into that. And then, but then I realized while I was there, I liked it, but I'm more, that type of comedic acting for me is more organic. So I knew I really wanted to do stand-up. I was too afraid. And I was like, it's just not going to happen. And then my brother started putting together the shows. He used to have this nonprofit organization in L.A. called the Levantine Center. And it was this sort of like Middle Eastern arts center. So you could learn about the Middle East through its arts and literature and all that. And he started putting together a show called Sultans of Satire. So he did the first, first couple shows. He said to me, I have two emerging comic spotlights on this one show coming up. You want one of them? I was like, no way. I'm not doing that. I'm not going in front of an audience. No way. You know, I thought I was cool. So I'm like, if I do this and that'll fracture my idea of how cool I am. You know, I go up and really eat shit and just fall on my face and eat a dick on stage, you know? And, as they used to say in those days. And then all of a sudden I had this weird medical scare. They thought I had some sort of, I don't know, a cancer or a tumor or something like that. And I was really worried about it, and everything went out of my mind. And then they were like, you need to come in. We're going to do a biopsy. We're going to put you asleep and do this biopsy. So I went in, and before they did the biopsy, I said to myself, I'm like, if this is – it had the possibility, and I think the odds were that it was something really bad.
Wow.
And I told myself, God, if this somehow is nothing, if this is somehow something smaller, something I can survive through, live through, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do all the things that I wanted to do. I'm going to do comedy. I'm just not going to give a shit anymore, which is not really true. People tell themselves that, but they're willing to at least step forward a little bit, right?
Yeah, the courage.
Yeah, so they did the biopsy, and it turned out it was something that was benign or something that wasn't that bad. And so I called him up like an idiot, and I was like, yeah, I'll take that, one of those emerging comics. But he's like, good, I had one left, and we have another guy who's like done comedy and stuff, and he's coming in, and he's going to do it. I'm like, all right. So then I'm like, oh, my God, I got to come up with the material. So
How much time do you have to do?
I think it was 5 to 7 minutes. Okay. I think it was like 7 minutes. And I was at my day job, and I was like, you know, writing stuff down, like looking around, and like in my head, I'm like, oh, man, I don't know if this is going to work. And
How did you time it? Like, how do you?
Well, I didn't know what I was doing. So I said, I'll just write everything I can think of, and then I'll go back. And if it's more, I'll cut it down. And so then I would go to my apartment at night. I would stand in front of the bedroom sliding closet door that had mirrors on it, and I'd take a wooden spoon and I'd pretend I was on stage and like go through and try to time it, right? And I was like, I gotta slow down, you know, I gotta do this, and I need more body movement. And you're just, it's like the worst. It's like, I don't know what it is. It's like doing surgery for the first time, right? And so then I was really nervous. I was like, maybe I'm just gonna call him, not do this, you know. And a couple weeks go by and everything, and I'm still practicing and like trying to figure out how to make the whole set of jokes work in like a arc or something, you know. And finally, it was a Friday night, and his last show had like low attendance. So I was like, you know, the good thing is there's probably like 10 people there. Nobody's going to give a shit anyway. So I call in sick to work. And I sit at home, and I'm like, I have to do this a million times. I can't go up there unprepared. You know, I'm scared shitless. So I'm thinking it's like, you know, you're practicing a monologue or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I'm going at it. And it's stuff that I've said that wrote down as jokes, but it's me practicing me retelling the things I said that were spontaneous.
Like hitting the beats.
Right? Yeah, you know. And so I get up there with the spoon and everything, and then finally I say, okay, fuck it, I'm going to go over there. It's like 7 o'clock at night. I go over to this place. It was in West Adams. It was called Fado Dough. There's like a.
I know Fado.
You know Fado. You know, yeah. So you know Fado Dough.
I played Fado Dough. Yeah.
And what's his name? Steven Yablock. Yeah. So Fado Dough, and he was doing the show there. And I walk in, and it's fucking packed. Oh. I mean, the entire place is jam packed. And then I find out that they're doing, Fox News is there, doing an interview because these are Middle Eastern comics, and it's after 9/11 and all that. So they're doing this interview with all the comics. And I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm like, oh, my God, what have I done?
You're like, I'm going to be sick.
Oh, fuck. I don't believe this. Then this other guy comes up to me that I met that night, and he's a very accomplished actor, a guy named Momo Casablanca, and he was doing stand-up for the first time, but he had done lots of comedic acting and acting. And he says to me, you know, we found out that there's these two spots and one of us has to go on first. So he's like, you know, so I'm thinking he's done more than me. So he and I are such idiots. We think taking the bullet or going first is like the esteemed position for comics, right? And later on I found out, you know, like after a couple shows, I found out a lot of comics don't like to go first because the crowd is sort of cold. They're not warmed up. And that's why I have a host and MC, because they have a really hard job, you know, and you want to get them soused up a little bit. And so he says, I was like, look, you've done this longer than me. He goes, he goes, okay, I'll go first. And so I have more experience. I'm like, okay. And so we get up there, you know, and then my brother gets up there to announce 11th Center. You know, we have this nonprofit and donate and blah, blah, blah. And he gets up there and he decides he's going to try his hand at comedy. He takes out a Time magazine article and starts reading. And he kind of looks like Jeff Goldblum when he squints too much, my brother, right? And he gets up there and he's like, yeah, Bush today said, and it was like, just like crickets.
Right.
And there was these four girls. I think they were Persian Armenian next to me. Beautiful. They're beautiful. And one of them goes like, oh my God, he's horrible. Like, hey, that's my brother. She's like, you better get up there and save him because he sucks. I was like, so then Momo gets up, and then Momo had it's his first time as well. So he got a little nervous and everything. And he'd been working with another comic we know, and he starts doing it, you know, and he goes, it does okay. And so now I'm like, oh fuck. And then the MC calls me up, and I'm going up on stage. I remember walking up the steps, and I had this feeling like, what the fuck, man? I just did this for like 20 hours in a row.
Right. You know, yeah, what do I got to lose?
Yeah. And I say this all the time at parties and amongst people all the time. Fuck it, dude. You know, and I had this weird feeling, almost like it's a challenge, you know, like,
right.
So I walk up on stage and I start going at it. And then at the first or second joke hits and I get a laugh, and now it's like heroin. Now I think I'm fucking, you know,
right.
I'm like, you know, I don't know, George Carlin or something like that. And up there, and I'm like walking on the stage and like, you know, pacing around.
Work in the room, yeah. Man.
You know, I think I'm like this massive comic, you know. And then I had written this horrible joke. I think it was about Brokeback Mountain, and I was talking about Middle Easterns, and I was like, you know, they should make movies based on, you know, the Middle East, like, you know, for Middle Eastern, you just do like a translation. I was like, you know, you could do like a Brokeback Mountain, you know, called Camelback Mountain. And I said, you know, can you imagine if the guy's there and he's like, you know, oh, Ahmed, I can't quit you. Say something. You know, it was like and then the whole audience laughed because, you know, I was a goat, you know, and it was really corny, but they liked it because they got the sort of direction it went in. And I thought, oh my God, man, I'm a natural. I'm a,
right. You know?
And then I did the next show I did after that, just fucking ate the biggest fucking shit hot dog. Like I could have jumped off the stage into a pool of complete shit of like, you know, like, yeah, exactly. Like, I jumped right into that toilet and started swirling down.
Yeah, you're like this. But you know what? Those are the shows that you learn the most.
Oh yeah, really?
But they're the most painful. They're the most painful. They really are. You know, it's like I did the Apollo Theater.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And man, you know, there was a comedian, and, you know, they kind of like put us in a room. They were like, hey, man, they don't like comedians up there. And the only guy that I was actually friends with in the room was the comedian.
Oh,
he was like, man, I'll be the first one. And I was like, man, I like this guy's confidence. It's great. And he went up there and he bombed. I mean, they were so harsh, and it killed me because I was like, and like they bring up like four or five people and they put this big wall in front of you. So you can't see, you can only hear what's going on, know? Because they don't want anybody to have an advantage, which I really liked, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm in Harlem doing this show, and they, like, totally messed with my amps, all my knobs.
Yeah.
And
they messed with your knobs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they did. And, you know, like, because of all the shows that I had failed and things have gone wrong, I knew how to stall.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, clap your hands, stomp your feet. This one's from Michael Jackson, because I was doing a Michael Jackson tune.
Mm.
And I had the whole room stomping while I had time to just die. Yeah, but I never would have learned that without all the shows that I failed.
Well, you know what I mean? If you learn the most from like bombing and
yes, you do.
Then I'm still learning. I'm still a student then.
No, I mean, frankly, but it really is. Like, because once you can only go up from there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it's true. And it's certain things, especially in the beginning, you have to learn that you don't. You don't pick up, like, you know, I used to hear comics tell me, one older comic told me this one time. He said the difference between a good comic is a bad comic is a good comic knows when he's bombing. He said that was like his litmus test or whatever, for that. And you know, you're in front of an audience, whether it's music, whether it's acting, whether it's, you know,
you can read them.
you see, they like it or they don't like it, you know. And there's some guys that have this magical ability to shift gears and sort of get them back on their side, like, you know, like Bill Burr. And I think they were in Philly or something like that, and the audience hated him. And he's like, you know, hey, fuckers, I have 8 minutes left. And by the end of the set, they hate him in the beginning.
You're talking about the Philly show.
Philly.
Yeah.
By the end of the set, they loved him. They're like, Bill Burr, Bill
Well,
Burr.
It's like the way he turned that whole audience of, like, people yelling at him, and he's just heckling them. You know, the funny thing is, I saw Russell Peters, and, you know, it was really strategic because, like, he didn't have anything rehearsed, but he had all the ethnic jokes, like, in his bank.
Yeah.
So he would just, like, walk around and ask people, like, oh, where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? And he had these banks of jokes. Or, you know, he would just ask them their name and twist that into a joke. And I was like, dude, he did that for an hour and 15 minutes. I was, like, really impressed because I'm like, basically he had nothing rehearsed and he had everything rehearsed. You
he's
know,
a,
so
he's like a master of that type of crowd.
Yeah.
He's like that in person, too. He's like rapid fire. Like, you'll say something and he'll take six words and then boom, 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 you know, and just – and whatever you're – like, if – he'll say something, and whatever you're thinking, he'll pull that word or that sensibility out of there and get to it before you get to it. So I'll, somebody will be like, you know, like you with the knob thing. Like, I would have gone to say that, and he would have done 6 minutes on it already. You know what I mean? Like, he already would have formulated, and you know, and
well, who are some of your biggest influences as comedians?
You know, I love George Carlin.
He's the best, man.
The unbelievable guy is a wordsmith, and he had this magical ability, and there's some comics that are out there like that. And just Chappelle is like this. They have this magic ability where they can take something so simple that is not even, it's not even sort of like lightly battered and funny, you know what I mean?
Right. Right.
And they can turn that into funny. Like he would say shit like, you know, buying is legal, fucking is legal. Why isn't buying fucking legal? When he's talking about prostitution, you know?
Right.
That type of shit. Or even Chappelle in his new Sticks and Stones, he does that bit about abortion. I mean, it's just, you're like, when you watch them, you say, well, how the fuck, I wish I'd thought of that. You
right.
Know? That's how you know they're great. So, like, George Carlin, Robin Williams was an amazing performer. He was a frenetic and just, he was like a sound machine. You know, he was like this almost like a ethereal, otherworldly creature you throw on stage and it starts up and, like, the WB Frog, and just goes, you know.
He was like the perfect physical comedian.
Unbelievable. You know? Yeah. And then, I got to tell you what, when I was a kid, you know, and every comic has his place and his time in the sun. When I was a kid, before all the shenanigans recently, Bill Cosby, Bill, you know, he's done what he's done and he's paying for it. And you know, he's being prosecuted by, you know, the law and by humanity, which he should be for, you know, if those things are true. But when he did comedy, he was outstanding.
Yeah.
You know, like Bill Cosby himself is one of the perfect comedy albums.
Right.
When I was a kid and I'd listen to that, you know, I was like, he would say, you know, my brother was God damn it, and I was Jesus Christ or whatever it was that he said, you know. And then I was like, my dad had names for me and my brother like that, like, you know, dumbbell and slowpoke or something like that, you know, or dipshit or whatever, you know. And I was like, you would relate to that, you know. And like when he talks about his wife coming, you know, my mother was like that, you know. So he was, and my mom, my ethnic heritage is completely different, but he still found that commonality. And you're just laughing because, you know, you see those observations. And got, you know, guys like that, like, you know, I really loved Rodney Dangerfield.
He was one of my favorites. You mentioned all my favorites. Yeah. The only one you didn't say was Eddie Murphy.
I love Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy, Delirious, is like one of the greatest.
Delirious and Raw.
Specials, yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. You know who else? Sam Kinison.
Yeah, I met Sam Kinison, man.
Oh, you're kidding me.
I met Sam Kinison at the Grammys when I was, when I sang backup for Mike and the Mechanics. And I got to meet him. And like, I just remember him. I got to watch him rehearse. Mm. And he came out and he was like, I can't read that board. He's like, Don, where the hell are you? I can't see you. And he was just like doing these little bits and it was making the whole room laugh.
Yeah.
Because he was in this character and I was kind of scared to meet him because I'd seen Back to School and he's yelling, you know, he does like, that stuff. And so when I met him, he was super cool and laid back and he had the whole beret and the whole get up. And I was like, man, I'm a huge fan. I think you're awesome. You were so great in Back to School. And he signed my little thing and he was super quiet.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked that he could separate those two, like that it was going to be a separation. Cause I just thought he'd be screaming in my face in like 2 seconds.
Yeah. But he was one of those guys that did the same thing. Like when you see the first big thing that I saw him in was the HBO Young Comedian special that Rodney Dangerfield would do.
Yep.
And he does that thing where he's talking about, you know, the whole, you know, the starving kids and Sally Struthers and all that. And you're like, God, it's, you know, here's sand. Food doesn't grow here. Move where there's food. Like, it's ridiculous, but it's awesome. Simple and genius, awesome. You know? It's there's even guys like Dennis Wolfsburg. You ever heard of this guy?
No.
In the 80s, he was big in the, I mean, he was a traveling comic in the 80s. He would do these things. He had this crazy way of talking. He looked like almost like a maniacal scientist, like a mad scientist. And he would say crazy shit. And he was like super Jewish, you know, and he was like, you know, I was once a substitute teacher in Mobile, Alabama, and I had a student named Fallopia or something like that. You know, he would just say random things, and he was so energetic, and like he looked like he was going to explode. And Richard Jenny, I loved Richard Jenny. Yeah. He was just so smart. I mean, the things he would say were just, he would pull these things out of the, you know, like just the ethos, and you're like, oh,
my God. You ever been to Rodney Dangerfield's grave?
No, where is it?
It's in Westwood, and I went with my girlfriend, and it was funny because we went to see like Marilyn Monroe, and he happened to be there. And on his grave, it says, "There goes the neighborhood." And I saw it, and I started laughing. I'm like, "Dude, he's still making me laugh." Like, he is, I think, one of the greatest of all time. He should be on the Mount Rushmore for sure.
Have you ever seen that clip of Eddie Murphy on the Actors Studio where he talks about Rodney Dangerfield?
No,
I think it was Actors Studio. I'll repeat it, but I'm sure I'm not doing it justice, but I think he asks Eddie Murphy, it's like, who are your inspirations? And then Eddie Murphy starts talking about Rodney Dangerfield. He mentions that when he was a young comic, and I think he started at 14 or 15 or something like that. He was in New Jersey, and he was at some club. He said Rodney Dangerfield was there, and then he asked him if he would stay and watch him, you know, to give him some pointers or whatever. I don't know what the situation was. And he gets on stage, and he does his act, and he gets off. And he says Rodney Dangerfield sort of like, you know, guided him and was like, you know, you're never going to work in this business. It's too dirty. You're working too blue. There's too much cursing. There's too much vulgarity, blah, blah, blah. You got to change it. And then he sort of walks away. And Eddie Murphy says basically that he was so like demoralized by it that, you know, it really brought him down. And then he sort of forgot about it and went on to become Eddie Murphy, Delirious Raw, all that. And then he said years later, he was in the bathroom at Caesar's Palace or something like that, a urinal. Who walks into the bathroom like four urinals down? Rodney Dangerfield. Unzips, starts taking a piss, and he looks over at him. He goes, "Who knew?" it's totally sounds like something he would say.
And it's awesome. It's awesome. Let's get to one of your clips. We got a clip of you. You want to tell us a little bit about this clip you got?
I was on the road with a buddy of mine, a big international headliner, Angelo Sorokis, and we were in Edmonton at Ricky Bronson's club there. I think we're at the Comic Strip in Edmonton. I believe it was Edmonton.
Yep,
Canada.
I think so.
And you know, Ricky's like a great Rick Bronson's a great comic, and he owns clubs and stuff, and very very gracious club owner. And I actually had the pleasure of working with him too. So he got on stage that weekend and everything. So he's a fantastic guy, and just you know, a long here in history in comedy and experience as well. And him and his wife were super nice, and so they were doing a special weekend, and I came along with Angelo, and he was like, "Well, why don't you, you know, do some shows, do some work?" I said, "Okay, great." So they filmed this clip that they were using for something else, and so this is me. I think it's a Friday or Saturday night show or something like that.
All right, here it is.
Put your hands together for my new lunch partner and shared his lemon with me, Noel L. Grablick.
Yes, Comic Strip, put your hands together for your host and MC, Mr. Rick Bronson. We are here tonight to bare our souls. We are comics. We have a depressed, sad background, and we turn that into comedy so you can enjoy our tragedy. I am no different. I grew up in a tough family. My parents had this really vicious, vicious divorce battle. There was a brutal custody battle afterwards. My dad won, so I ended up living with my mom. My name is Noel. Does anybody know what Noel means? Anybody? Christmas. Wow, look at that. You guys are bilingual. Christmas, that's right. Beautiful, beautiful French word, which means Christmas. Joyeux Noël. And I am Jewish. I am the Christmas Jew. I don't know what the fuck my dad was thinking. Doesn't fit. It's like if Donald Trump had a kid and named him Jose. Just doesn't fucking fit. You know what I mean? It's funny how people look at you and, you know, they all of us, we're sort of victims of sometimes of generalization. People look at you and they don't, you know, they kind of, they kind of guess where you're from. They don't know, quite know, and you, it happens in public. The other day I was with some friends. We were in Hollywood. We were hanging out at this comedy club after we were done doing our sets, and we were talking about our backgrounds and everything, and I mentioned that I was Jewish. And I walked outside to get my car from the valet, and this girl who was in the club kind of saunters up to me, and she's like, "Excuse me?" I'm like, "Yeah." She goes, "Excuse me, are you really Jewish?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she goes, "How did you get into that?" Okay, well, how did I get into that? That's a good question. So this is what I did. I walked into a bank. I filled out an application. Boom, my dick shrunk, my nose grew, and all of a sudden I had great business ideas. How the fuck do you think I got into this? My dad actually had me when he was older. My dad had me when he was, you know, in his 40s, 45, mid-40s. He actually was in the Holocaust. He was in Europe during the occupation during World War II. It's a somber issue for our family. I had lost my grandfather, my aunt, and all that. And real depressing thing, except that wasn't a tough part. The tough part was growing up, I had this huge responsibility on my shoulders. I could never complain about anything. It would never match what my dad went through. No matter how mundane of a task we did. We'd go to get shoes or something like that. He'd be like, "What kind of shoes you want? Come on, hurry up. What kind of shoes you want?" I'm like, "Dad, I got to get these Nike Air Jordans." He's like, "Nike Air Jordans? How much are those?" $100. $100? $100, huh? When I was your age, we used to light our limbs on fire to keep warm and stay away from the Nazis and the death camps. All right, Pops, maybe I'll just get a fucking pair of sandals. How about that? You know what I mean? He worked in the restaurant business, loved food. He was a big foodie, but he hated to waste food. So he had like 3 or 4 restaurants. Every night he'd come home after closing up shop, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd have these big chafing dishes of like tortellini or pasta or something like that. Couldn't stand wasting, so he'd wake me up. He'd be like, "Come on, let's go in the living room. Let's get some pasta. Let's finish this. We shouldn't waste this food." I said, "Okay." I'd get up and I'd go through the living room. It's late at night. He's wearing his, like, you know, black socks and running shorts and a tank top. And we're just sitting there ladling in fucking tortellini or whatever, just eating it all. And he'd turn on the TV, put on his favorite channel, you know. It had that Cinemax. You remember that Cinemax After Dark, what they call it, your Blue Nuit, something like that? Like a dirty porn, soft porn after night. And he'd watch it. He'd be obsessed with it. It'd be like this weird gay guy pretending to be straight with his dick taped to his leg. Like, "Oh, my God, this vagina is so accommodating and moist." It'd be some weird thing like that, you know. And my dad would have some trippy flashback from the 60s, and he would be like, "Oh, my God, it reminds me of Los Angeles in the 60s. It was a wild and free place, a lot of sex. One time I was at this orgy, I was with this girl. She said, 'No, no, no.' I said, 'Yes, yes, yes.' Bang, she came like a river." You know what I'm talking about, kid? I'm like, "No, Dad, I'm 8 fucking years old. I have no idea what you're talking about." So I did what any good Jewish boy should do. I married a Mexican Catholic girl. It was a great move, huh? How many married people we got in here? Married people? Single? Kind of quiet. The single people always in the back in the darkness. They're always like hiding, you know. Stay back there. Don't worry. Marriage is, they're not going to tell you this, but marriage is like a timeshare. You don't know how fucked you are until it's too late. You know what I mean? When I was single, I wanted to fuck everything. When I was married, I wanted to fuck everything else. That's what happens. Yeah, I married a Mexican Catholic girl. My mom was okay with her. My mom was cool with her. They'd call. They'd talk to each other. They'd insult me behind my back. Her mom, not so good with me. She was not happy about it. She had this little nickname for me. She called me El Amigo del Diablo, which I'm pretty sure means friend of the devil. Yeah, you know, it's what are you going to do? But she, over years, she kind of warmed up to me. She wanted to build kind of like a bond with me, and she got kind of better. And she would call me up, and she'd try to say, you know, nice things on Jewish holidays. Like, she'd call me up, and she'd be like, "Hello, Noel." I'm like, "Hey, how's it going, Ricardo? I want to wish you a happy Tupac Shakur." I'm like, "What the fuck is Tupac Shakur?" "You know, the holiday where you don't eat for a day." So that's Yom Kippur. "Fuck you, kill Jesus." That was it. You know? I got married, I inherited 3 kids. Yeah, 3 kids, Adwater instant family. 3 boys, 7, 8, and 13. It was crazy. It was unbelievable. They were everywhere. They came into the house. They destroyed everything. They destroyed my paintings, my record collection. The refrigerator was empty. They broke the TV. The little one put his finger in the dog's ass. I don't know what happened. It's unbelievable. And they were there all the fucking time. They were like bed bugs. I couldn't get rid of them. You know what I mean? I mean, making love to my wife, and the door would open. I see the little one come out. fucked up everything for me and my wife and our internet viewers. It was horrible, man. It was just fucking... So when the kids weren't there, they'd be gone, camp or their grandmother's house or something like that. Sometimes we just let loose, you know, we'd go and turn on the TV and spark up a joint, have a little bit of the herb, you know. And one night we were doing that, we were watching TV, I pulled out a joint, we start smoking it, split the joint. I said, no, we're feeling kind of frisky. She's getting frisky. She climbs up on top of me. We start getting hot and heavy. We start making love. We're fucking. I'm just talking crazy to her. I'm like, yeah, baby, you like that? You love that shit, don't you? She's like, what are you doing? I was like, what do you mean? She goes, what are you doing? You sound like a black guy. I was like, yeah, you like that shit, girl. She's like, listen, you sound like a black guy. You don't feel like one. I'm like, thanks, honey. Thanks a bunch. She was always worried that I wouldn't bond with the kids. I wanted to be a good stepdad. She wanted me to be a good stepdad. And they weren't bad kids. You know, they're just one of those things where it's a hard thing to kind of bridge the gap. So I came up with this great idea. I figured, you know, I'm going to buy a little puppy. I'll get this little Labrador puppy. We'll raise it. We'll teach it how to walk and do tricks and all those things, and then we'll bond that way. So I did. I got this beautiful puppy. We took her out. We fed her. I showed them how to do the discipline, the obedience, how to clean up her poop, the whole nine yards, and we got really close. But then what happened was a really strange thing. All of a sudden, my wife got jealous. She got jealous of the time all of us were spending together. So one day, we're in the bedroom. We're sleeping. It's like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Puppy jumps up on the bed, starts frolicking around. My wife wakes up in the middle of the night, like the Exorcist, and she's like, get the fucking dog off the bed. I'm like, whoa, calm the fuck down. It's just a puppy. She's like, you know what? Sometimes I think you like that dog more than you like my kids. I was like, well, you're probably right. I mean, it's a... She's like, what's the reasoning for that? I said, let me tell you something. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that puppy's ever going to say, fuck you, you're not my real dad. That's just not going to happen. You know? It's a lot of responsibility. She's always worried if I was happy. She'd call me up. I'd be driving around. Every day was the same thing. I'd get a call. It'd be some weird question. She'd call me up. Are you happy? I'm like, yeah, I'm happy. No, I mean, like, you're really happy? I'm like, yeah, I'm happy. She's like, in life, you found your bliss. I'm like, yeah, to a certain degree. And she goes, let me ask you a question. Let's say you're walking on a beach. And you trip over a lamp and a genie comes out. I was like, is this because I'm Jewish and Middle Eastern? She's like, no, just follow along with me. You're walking on the beach. You trip over a lamp. A genie comes out. And he grants you one wish. He says, I grant you one wish. What would your wish be? And I was like, shit. You really want to know? You want me to be brutally honest? She's like, yeah. I said, okay. I wish your kids were mine. And she started crying. She started sobbing. She's like, I love you so much. I love you. Why are you so sweet? Why would you say it? I said, that way I could beat the shit out of them. That's why. So I'm dating again. Back on the market. And I hadn't been dating since before these new apps came out. Tinder and Bumble and all these things. And like, I started dating this Asian girl I met on Tinder. And my friends were like, all of a sudden, it's the only Asian girl I've ever dated. And all of a sudden they were like, you know what? You got yellow fever. I was like, yellow fever? What the fuck are you talking about? The first Asian girl I've ever dated. You got yellow fever. I'm like, what are you fucking talking about? It's okay. You guys should do some role playing. I was like, what do you mean role playing? You know, like, do some role playing in the sack. I was like what? I'm a wizard or a goblin or something? Like, no, you know, just, you know, spice things up. So I came home one night and I was like, you know, we should do some role playing, you know? And she was like, what do you mean by role playing? I was like, you know, I'll put on some fatigues, maybe a helmet. I'll kick down the door with a rifle and I'll be like, hey, is Charlie in here? And she's like, what the fuck? What the fuck are you talking about? I was like, just, you know, do the accent. She's like, I'm not doing the fucking accent. I was like, just try it. No way. I was like, all right, tell you what. You just move your lips while we're making love and I'll do it, right? We're fucking. They'll be like, oh, you fuck me too hard, G.I. You fuck my pussy so good. Something, you know what I mean? Some shit. And she's like, yeah, I'll do the accent if you pretend to feel like a black guy. I was like, fuck you. Fuck you. You know what I mean? So now I just date homeless chicks. At the end of the night, you ask them, hey, you want to stay over? They're always like, yes. You know, it's fucking fantastic. The most important thing I learned is never date a girl that has mirrors on her bedroom wall. That's not going to work. It's not going to work, man. I met this girl, beautiful Venezuelan girl, 5'6", 5'7", caramel skin, beautiful body, small waist, charming accent, the whole nine yards. We went out 4, 5, 6 times. finally, she's like, come over to my house. I'm going to make you dinner. I'm like, all right. So I come over to her house. She makes this incredible dinner. It's Venezuelan meal. It's delicious. We start sharing a bottle of wine. I have a couple glasses. One thing leads to another. We're in her bedroom. We're fooling around. We're making out. Next thing I know, I'm fucking her from behind. I'm in heaven. Literally, that was her name, heaven. And we're going at it. I look over, and in the mirror, I can see my fat, dirty, hairy, sweaty ass pumping away. I'm like, oh, 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 oh. I look like one of those creatures from Bram Stoker's Dracula or the werewolf from Twilight, like an ogre pushing a wheelbarrow through a door. It doesn't fit. I'm like, oh, oh, like I'm sawing something with my dick like that, sir. Like there's just sawing that. Oh, like that, you know, with my cock. Just sawing shit in half, brother. A stiff cock with the ridges on it, you know. I step back. She's like, what's wrong? What's wrong, mi amor? Do I turn you off? I'm like, no, I turn me off. Don't you have any self-respect? How can you fuck that guy? All right, guys, that's my time. Noel Gravely, thank you so much.
Dude, that was great.
Put your hand.
Thanks, bro.
That was awesome. Man, I was cackling. I mean, the mics were off, but you heard me laughing. Dude. You're a wordsmith with jokes, man.
I don't know about that.
You're a jokester. Let me ask you this, too. When are you performing next? Where can people find you online, too?
So, yeah, we'll pop around town and do a lot of spots at different clubs. It's kind of like working out, so I'll pop in, pop out. I think the next show, the next kind of big show I'm doing is a friend of mine does this series of shows. I got to find it. Let's see here. He just sent me a text. Where is it? October 17th at Flappers.
Okay. That's in Burbank, right?
Yeah, Burbank. It's off of, I guess it's Olive and First there.
Yeah.
I think it's a show he's doing there, a big show on October 17th. I think it's, he's Armenian, so it might be like an Armenian show or some type of theme to it or something like that, but I'll be there doing a set in that show. And then, you know, people can always check Facebook, wherever I'm constantly posting stuff, wherever I'm going to be, and we'll try pop around town, like go to Orange County or here or there or whatever, you know.
And you have any links that people can find you online?
Yeah, my Facebook's got some links, and then I also have a website, www.noelelgrably.com, which
is... Spell it out, because people are dumb.
www.noelelgrably.com.
And you update that pretty regularly, I'm sure.
Yeah, from time to time. You know,
sometimes it's tough, is it? You know,
So whenever you do stuff, you try to pop it up on Facebook and Instagram or whatever and just set it out there. Because what happens is your friends will say, they'll be like, oh, I didn't know you were doing a show yesterday. I came in and they told me you were doing a show. And I was like, yeah, I only put it on Facebook and Instagram like 30 times.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people just don't pay attention, or they're not aware. Or they're like, dude, you should come to Seattle. It's like, what? I can't just come to Seattle. I have expenses. You know?
Or do musicians have this? Do you guys have this? You're doing a show and you've been set. Let's say you set up a show. You set it up at some show. It's going to happen in like 2-3 months, and you're like put a lot of effort into it and all that. And you want to do it, you know, just have this great event. And you tell your friends, listen, if you guys want to go, let me know. I'm just going to put you on the list. You come to the show, right? And then what they'll do is like 30 minutes before the show, the entire time before that, 2-3 months, they don't say a word. 30 minutes before the show, you start getting texts and calls. And all of a sudden, people have had a frontal lobotomy. And they'll be like, what's the Comedy Store and how do you get there? Is there parking on the street? I mean, how do you?
Website, man. Website.
Yeah, I'm like, use the internet, man. Use navigation. Weren't you raised in LA? You know, like, I'm like,
yeah.
And they have all of a
sudden. Or I'll post like 4 times what the times I'm actually going on. And they'll be like, what time are you going on? I'm like, seriously? You got a viral text? You got a viral post? I don't know how else to let you know, but it's part of it. But dude, you are one talented dude.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks for doing this show tonight.
It was a pleasure.
You got to come back. You got to come back.
Oh, yeah. Anytime. Anytime,
man,
you want, buddy.
You are a very talented cat. One more time. Noel Elgrably. Did I say it right this time?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Yes, man. All right. Well, check him out online. NoelElgrably.com. And check him out October
17th at Flappers.
At Flappers. There we go. What time?
Wow. You know, I should have actually looked this stuff up.
We'll say 8 o'clock. We'll say 8. Well, you tell me.
Let's see. I'll pull it up right now. Let's see.
Then we can get the 411.
The 411.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
Internet slow.
Wait for it. Ah. It's coming.
There it is. Let's see here. Okay, it's called the Armenian All-Stars. Mary Basmajian presents. It's going to be October 17th, 8 p.m. at Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank in the main room.
Awesome. You heard it here first. Go check it out, and we'll see you guys here next week.
Thanks so much, guys.